Thank you for downloading the podcast. My guests today were Tasmin Little and Daniel Barenboim. A few weeks ago, I was privileged to meet the highly gifted conductor and pianist Daniel Barenboim. I'd luckily seen him conduct the Berlin Staatskapelle the night before at the Royal Festival Hall in London as part of the South Bank Barenboim project. Daniel Barenboim is a real hero of mine, a key influence, I would say, in my love of classical music. He was completely charming and put me at ease straight away. Maestro, welcome to Classic FM.
Thank you.
And firstly, I would like to say that I was very lucky to be at last night's concert, and it was an incredibly special evening, wonderful music making.
Thank you
particularly
very much.
The Elgar Second
yes,
Symphony.
Yeah.
Now, that concert was part of the Barenboim project at the Royal Festival Hall. I wonder if you could tell me a bit more about the Barenboim project.
But I'm afraid you have to ask the Royal Festival Hall authorities. It was their idea. I don't know. But basically, coming January will be 60 years of my first concert at the Festival Hall. That's why I said yesterday to the audience that I've been playing in the Festival Hall since the hall was 5 years old.
Yes.
It starts now with these two concerts with the Staatskapelle, the Schubert recitals
yes.
Next month, and then on the actual day itself in January.
And you're also going to be giving the Edward Said lecture, aren't you, this year?
Yes.
I wonder what theme you're going to take as your subject for that lecture.
This is something that I also wonder. I haven't really quite decided yet. Probably something to do with music education or something like this, because it was a
That's
subject...
That's very dear to your heart, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, and it was to his too.
Yes.
And, you know, his fame as, I would say, political... I can't say activist, because he was much more than that, for a political personality and his capacity to... analysis of the situation in the Middle East in general, and particularly in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This he sort of shadowed so many of his other interests, but he was one of the most well-rounded human beings I ever met. And the question of... I think secretly he wanted to be a pianist, and as he himself put it, but I was too lazy to practice. And when he was in Cairo, he had a Polish piano teacher who also encouraged him, but he was not to be had on that. But the question of music education and the importance of music for the development of the brain, mm-hmm. in children especially at the beginning,
yes.
was something that was very dear to his heart. So something along those lines. I haven't really written it down yet.
Now, last night after the concert, to the delight of everybody, I think, in the hall, you received the Elgar Society Medal, and you've always been a great champion of Elgar. Now, I think in this country we tend to think of him as quintessentially English, and I wondered how German audiences respond to his music.
Well, the German audiences respond extremely, extremely well when the works are well played. You know, I've done... the Second Symphony very often. I did it many years ago with the Philharmonic also. I did the Dream of Chorontius with the Philharmonic and Falstaff. I've played quite a lot, you know. But, of course, Elgar, there is something English about his music, like there is something German about Brahms or something Italian about Verdi or something Czech about Smetana and Dvořák. Of course, for a long time, the national element in the music that was composed was a very important element. I still think even today it is. I think even Pierre Boulez, for all his the influence he acknowledges of the Second Viennese School, and all that, he remains a French composer when you really think of the colors of the instrumentation and everything. But of course, before the 20th century, it was even stronger. But I think there is no reason to think of Elgar as, shall we say, only as an English composer. You know, he's also fit for international
yes.
consumption. And I get very annoyed about that. You know, I said it yesterday too. I get very annoyed about it when you say, oh, and then he conducted the Second Symphony or the First Symphony or Falstaff by the English composer Edward Elgar. I mean, you know, you don't say by the Italian composer Giacomo Puccini. There's something slightly belittling, you know, that in other words, it's okay for England, you know. England
yes.
is not known for its great composers, and there was no great composer between Purcell and Elgar, you know. Okay, or maybe all right, but Elgar is what he is, and he's a great composer and a great orchestrator, and as such, he has to be liked or not, respected or not, but on the quality of his instrument, of his works, and not related to his nationality. It's belittling him.
Yes,
you know?
I understand that
get very annoyed about that. In England, it's done with a certain amount of pride, which is understandable, but outside is denigrating.
The fourth movement of the sublime cello concerto by Edward Elgar, played wonderfully by Jacqueline Dupré. The Philadelphia Orchestra was conducted by my guest this afternoon, Daniel Barenboim, on Classic FM. When I met Maestro Barenboim a few weeks ago, I was curious to know what inspired him to become a conductor, having begun his career as a virtuoso pianist.
My father, who was my teacher, you know, made me very much aware very early on that the piano as such was a very neutral instrument. You know, in other words, any weight you put on the keys produces sound.
Yes.
If you take this microphone and you put it on the black keys, it will make it not particularly beautiful. It will not remind you of Arthur Rubinstein's tone, but it makes a sound. But try to do that on the violin or on the oboe, you get nothing.
Yes.
Therefore, the piano basically is a very neutral instrument. And the piano becomes interesting only when you put colors on it, when you, as it were, orchestrate on it.
Yes.
I like to say that the piano is like a white wall without any color, you put any color, and the other instruments all have a color, red, yellow, whatever the case may be. And so I was always educated to orchestrate, as it were, on the piano. And then one day I thought, why do I have to do that when I can also have the real thing, have the real oboe and the real violins and all this thing? So I was very interested in all, from that, that was the departing point. And then I started conducting.
Yes.
Because although some of my instrumental colleagues don't think so, conducting is also a profession. Mm-hmm. The fact that you are a good or even a great pianist, violinist, or cellist does not really give you the license to conduct. But now it's become in fashion, play, conduct, and it is actually counterproductive. Mm-hmm. Because if you have you're a pianist or a violinist and you have a sympathetic conductor, he will bring the orchestra to play as you imagine, as you wish. But he does it. If you play and conduct and are not a conductor, they are left to their own devices and you are limited to some kind of cute way, you know, listen how I play this, you know, and
yes.
Can you do it like this? But this is not conducting. It is a lack of respect for the profession of conductors. I get very militant about that because it's become very much a fashion, mostly as a result of economic necessity to
yes.
spare one fee. And I think this is really very bad. And it's a great shame because some very great instrumentalists, you know, they call it play and conduct. They don't. They play without conductor.
Yes.
There's a difference between to play and conduct, for which you have to be both a player and a
conductor,
or to play without a conductor. But anyway, that's not important.
Are there any conductors who were real heroes of yours when you were growing up?
Yes, I was very lucky. I met Furtwängler when I was 11 years old, and I cannot claim that I immediately understood his greatness. But you know what it is, when as a child you meet somebody that is very impressive, you know, then it's sort of, when you get curious, and I got very curious. He died the year I met him.
Soon after that.
I don't think the two events were related. but I had sort of tasted his charisma.
Yes.
And I was very interested in what he had done, and I listened to all his records and read his books and articles. And he was and remains, for me, the model of everything that is good and positive about music making.
Now, I read somewhere that you'd like to travel in time in order to spend 24 hours with Mozart. I wondered...
Absolutely.
Of course. I wondered why you chose Mozart.
Because I think he was probably the only composer who had the combination to such a degree, the perfect combination between seriousness, talent, genius, in fact, and lightheartedness and facility.
Yes.
And I would find it so extraordinary, exhilarating to spend 24 hours just watching how he did what, you know? I mean, I'm very happy, for instance. I love Brahms's music too, I think, but I don't feel the need, you know, to spend 24 hours. Maybe the one thing to share a good cigar with him, that is. But, you know, the combination of depth and lightness,
yes,
and facility and talent, and it was oozing out of him. It was as if he was taking dictation from some other. You cannot explain otherwise the sheer quantity of his writing.
Now, you're also famous for your work that you do with young musicians, and you co-founded with Edward Said the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. What would you say were the key achievements of your work with that orchestra?
Well, the orchestra was created sort of accidentally. Mm. The idea came about in 1998, when Weimar was declared cultural capital of Europe. Was the first city of former East Germany to be named such. And the man who ran it was mostly a man of the theater and literature, and I think maybe a little ballet too, but less so music. Mm. And he asked me if I would help him make a music program. And I said, I can't. At the time, I was music director in Chicago, artistic director of the Staatsoper in Berlin. I was conducting in Bayreuth. I said, but I will help you, because it's a very good idea. I will help you there. But there are many people who can make good programs. It doesn't have to, it's no false modesty. You know, there are many people who can really make good, interesting programs. And he says, no, you're the only one who can do that, because, as you may know, Weimar represents both the very best and the very worst in German history. It was the city of Goethe, but it is only 5 kilometers away from the Buchenwald concentration camp.
Yes.
A fact which I have forgotten. And he says, and this is why, you know, because I had written articles about the Middle East, etc. And I said, I cannot help you make the programs, but I will come and make a little workshop if you want, for young Israelis and Arabs, in other words, for all the countries of the Middle East. I said, if you Germans have a sense of responsibility for the past, which I find extremely important and very laudable, then you must help the Jewish people, not by just building monuments to remember the Holocaust, but also help them in their predicament now, which is the conflict with the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. This is how the whole idea started. And we thought we would do, then I said, I can do that with Edward Said, who is my friend, and he was very excited. And so we said, that's what we were aiming at. Mm-hmm. But I said, let us start to find young musicians from the Arab world, because we don't know neither the quantity nor the quality. We know the quality and quantity in Israel, but we don't know. Even Edward Said, who knew everything there is to know about the Arab world, didn't know. And so we started with that, and you can imagine my amazement when there were over 200 applicants from the Arab world alone. And that's how the orchestra was created.
Maestro, this has been a real privilege for me. You're very much my musical hero. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
That was Chardash by Vittorio Monti, played by my guest this afternoon, the violinist Tasmin Little, with the pianist John Lenehan. We're going to be talking about your career and your recordings, and I'd like to take you right back to when it all began. What was it about the violin that attracted you as a small child?
The thing is that I grew up with a lot of music going on in the house because my father was an actor, and he took part in so many musicals, West End musicals like Oliver and Fiddler on the Roof. And, you know, so and they loved, my parents loved music. And so there was a lot of music that was going on, and my sister and I just literally grew up with the record player, as it was then, this beautiful box of wood on stilts and things. So different. And so, you know, music was forever on in the house. And so I already knew about instruments and how they sounded. But it wasn't until I was six and nearly seven, and when I had chicken pox, that I began to think about actually playing a musical instrument. I was terribly bored in bed and very sort of isolated because none of my friends was allowed to visit me. And so I turned to my mum and asked if she would kindly buy me a recorder. And so I taught myself to play the recorder, and I really enjoyed it. And then when I got better, my sister and I started piano lessons, and I thought that it would be wonderful to try the violin because I loved the singing sonority of that instrument.
That's what really attracted you.
Yes, the sound that the violin makes, I find a very personal sound. Yes. A lot of people liken it to the human voice, and I think with the way that you draw the bow across the string and this very personal ringing of vibrato and the kind of sound that you make is very individual. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not to say that other instruments don't also have their individual sound, but I do find something very, very touching and very personal about the sonority of a violin.
Now, you were obviously a very talented child because you won a scholarship to the Yehudi Menuhin school. I wonder what your memories are of Yehudi Menuhin and whether you saw him that much.
Well, we were very lucky at the school at this point in time because even though Yehudi was still pursuing a very busy career internationally, he found time to come and visit the school at least four times a year, and he would hear every single one of us, even me, the baby of the school when I first arrived, aged eight, and I was having to relearn how to use my bow and all sorts of things. But, you know, he was as devoted listening to me going through some rather dull exercises as he was listening to some of the older members, such as Nigel Kennedy, play César Franck's sonata.
And what was it like at such a young age playing in front of a man who's a musical legend? Was it a bit daunting?
Yes, it was a bit daunting, but not nearly as daunting as it might have been had he not been the kind of personality that he was. He was a very informal and very humble man. He was quietly spoken. He was a bit like one's granddad, really. you know, he sort of had very informal clothes. He wore a cardigan and a shirt. You know, I mean, my thought of him before I met him was that he must at least be in a three-piece suit with a bow tie. I don't know that I ever saw him in one of those. But he just was that kind of personality that wanted to put people at ease. And he wasn't at all the kind of, you know, standoffish musician that, yes, that he might have been.
Well, I'd like to play another of your recordings. We've just heard the Chardash. This is the fourth movement of the Scottish Fantasy by Max Bruch. That was the fourth movement of the Scottish Fantasy by Max Bruch, played by my guest this afternoon, Tasmin Little, with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Vernon Handley on Classic FM. Tasmin, your 50th birthday, I hope I can say that, is coming up this Wednesday.
Indeed.
And Classic FM is going to be noting your birthday by having a full works concert, which consists of your choices of recordings. It starts off with the Bach Brandenburg Concerto No. 6, but you have also chosen the Scottish Fantasy by Brook. Is that an important piece for you?
It's an important piece and also an important recording for me, which I made with one of my most favourite and sadly no longer with us conductors, Vernon Handley, who everybody affectionately referred to as Todd. And I've always been very proud of this recording. You know, when you grow up and you listen to recordings that become favourite recordings, and then you get to record the piece yourself, there's always that feeling of, I hope I'm going to do as good a job as the recording that inspired me to play this piece. And the recording that inspired me was that of Jascha Heifetz, which is a very famous recording. He probably was the main person that championed the Scottish Fantasy, and then it sort of fell a little bit by the wayside. And at the point in time that I recorded it with Todd, it was not at all the popular piece that it's become, and I'm thrilled that it's become popular again because it's a wonderful work. But when I made this recording, particularly the opening movement, which is a very it starts very tragically and rather movingly, and I really wanted to get that bit right because it was the haunting opening that had lured me into the piece in the first place. And I feel so happy with the way that the recording turned out, and even all these years later, it's a recording that I feel immensely proud of.
Well, it'll be a welcome chance to hear it on your birthday. And finally, we end up with the Schubert Rondo Brillant, which features on your new album of Schubert chamber music. Again, this piece obviously has resonance for you. What is it about it that you like so much?
I think this is a fantastic piece, and it's amazing to think that there are pieces of Schubert that aren't played terribly often, but this is one of them. And it really shouldn't be. It's the most, well, I hope very much that the audience will enjoy listening to it. I think you almost couldn't not enjoy it. It starts it's Rondo Brillant. It starts very brilliantly. It's extremely virtuosic for both the violin and the piano. And then it's got this marvellous, exciting theme when the fast section gets going, and it just really rolls on in a fantastically exciting and passionate way, and then it gets faster and faster and comes to its triumphant conclusion. And I just think it's a super piece, and I'm going to be playing it a lot in concert, and I really hope that people will begin to get to know it and that it will then achieve the popularity that it deserves.
Now, I mentioned your new CD earlier. This is your first double CD, isn't it?
It is, and I'm so excited. People talk about their double albums and things, and I've never done one, and now I have. And I feel really, really happy about it. And what I love about this album is the way that we trace Schubert's development of the violin and piano association together. So it starts with his early sonatas or sonatinas, even they're called in a little sonatas. And then we move through onto the more developed duo sonata in A major, and then this fantastic Rondo Brillant, and then the great fantasy, which it has got to be one of the most amazing chamber works that exists. It's extremely difficult. But of course, Schubert being Schubert, it has got such lyricism. So there's really, really a feast of fantastic music.
Lots to look forward to. Now we're going to hear you again, and this is Schubert. It's the violin sonata in G minor, Number 3, and it's the first movement. That was the first movement of the violin sonata in G minor, number 3, by Franz Schubert, played by my guest this afternoon, Tasmin Little, with the pianist Piers Lane on Classic FM. Tasmin, you're going to be one of the jurors for the 2016 Yehudi Menuhin International Violin Competition, along with Ray Chen, who was a guest of mine a few weeks back. How important is a competition like this for an aspiring young violinist?
I think that this particular competition is a wonderful competition from all sorts of points of view. Sometimes people can be tempted to say, oh, competition's very cutthroat and, you know, very, very difficult feeling inside, and people are all very competitive in not the right way. But this is a real celebration of violin. And what one of the things that makes it different is that we, the jury members, each of us play as well. And I think that's very important, because I don't particularly like the idea of just sitting back and watching aspiring young players go through the hoops. You know, we're all in it together.
Yes,
and I think it, there's something very right about the feeling that we're all going to participate in, you know, in every way possible. And so I really like that about the competition. I was a jury member on the competition a couple of years ago in Beijing, and that was a marvellous experience. And although I don't do an awful lot of jury work, I enjoyed it so much that when I was invited to participate and be a jury member for the upcoming competition, I said, yes, I would like to. Of course, it's a special year as well, because it's going to be the centenary of Yehudi's birth. And so there's a real feeling, I think, of celebrating everything that he felt was so important about music, which is obviously that music is such a valuable and wonderful aspect of so many people's lives. And I really don't think that there exists a single human being on the planet that doesn't respond to music, not necessarily classical music, although I do feel that most people can respond to classical music. And there's such a wealth of different kind of music out there. But Yehudi was very much one for using music to build bridges and using music to try to bring people closer. And I'm sure that the spirit of that is going to be part of the competition again.
Now, your violin is sitting here with us in the studio. I haven't yet seen it. You haven't brought it out. But it's a Guadagnini, isn't it? So
that's
it
right,
must be the most magnificent instrument to play.
Oh, it's a wonderful instrument. It was made in 1757. So it's quite an extraordinary thought to think that Mozart was only 1 year old when my violin was made. And, you know, when you think of all the amazing players that my violin must have seen, and perhaps some composers as well, it's fantastic. They're not just amazing, beautiful pieces of artwork. They are also sort of full of memory and history as well. So from that point of view, I think that you know, these great instruments are just completely unique.
You've also played a Stradivarius, haven't you?
Yes, I was very lucky. I had on loan for 13 years a magnificent Stradivarius, the Regent Stradivarius. Sadly, the collection was recalled, and so I don't play it anymore. But sometimes there are instruments that come into one's life and you have the opportunity to play them, and it brings out different aspects to your own playing. So I don't in any way regret the opportunity that I had. And luckily, of course, I still have my beautiful instrument to play.
Indeed,
So I'm very fortunate.
Now, when you were growing up, who were the violinists who inspired you?
Well, one person really inspired me more than anybody, and that is the great violinist Ida Haendel. I think the fact that she was one of, at that point in time, very few women players was quite an inspiration to me. She's such a strong person. She's such a strong player. And I loved her charisma, and I loved the way that she showed her great strength in her playing, as well as the more tender and vulnerable sides as well. And I think, you know, to have a role model like that, a really strong woman role model, was a very important thing to me. And of course, Yehudi Menuhin inspired me. And the other violinist that's always been a great favourite of mine is David Oistrakh.
Oh, yes.
And he had such a stunning sound, such a personal sound, and just that warmth and glow to his tone was very mesmerising.
Tasmin, this has been fascinating. I could talk to you for hours more, but I do want to say happy birthday for Wednesday.
Thank you
very much for coming in.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you again for downloading the podcast. I hope you'll join me next Sunday from 3, when my guests include the cellist Stephen Isilis.